And now, it's time for the talk of the Northwest. The 9 to Noon Show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Yes, good morning. 3 minutes, just turning 4 minutes past nine on this Thursday, the 26th of September. And it is Thursday's edition of the 9 till noon show, and our lines are open for you right now. We've lots lined up for you, covering all the big topics of the day, of course, highlighting issues of concern to you and your local community. But if there's an issue you want to raise with us, then give us a text, 086 60 25000, 086 60 25000, or drop us a call on 07491 25000. You can message us on Facebook, any of our Facebook pages, we'll collect them for you. Or if you want to message me directly too, of course you can, just search out Greg Hughes and send me one off there. Right, it's Thursday, so lots of papers to get through, so let's start with the Donegal Democrat. Deer hunters leave family in tears. Connie Duffy writes that a Donegal family says they're living in fear of hunters trespassing near their land in an attempt to kill wild deer. It comes after they encountered a party of deer hunters stalking a young doe or female deer in a field near their home outside Letterkenny last week. The men fired shots, one into the family's back garden and another close to their actual house. They eventually killed the young deer, which was standing in a field beside the family home, and when challenged about their actions, claimed they had the right to go wherever they wanted. Wild deer are protected species under our Wildlife Act. However, criminals are increasingly exploiting deer for financial gain, creating animal welfare issues and a risk to human health. Right, loads more on that in the Democrat today and other stories as well, of course. Do you have any more information on that for us? Give us a call, 07491 25000. The Tyrconnell Tribune, Fine Gael's kitchen cabinet meets in private. As speculation gathers pace in preparation for an imminent general election, the Tribune has learned that an urgent meeting has taken place of a Fine Gael kitchen cabinet on Monday evening. The secret meeting, called at less than 24 hours' notice, took place on the verge of one of Ireland's most tidy towns. However, no members of the local press got an invite and no press statements were issued afterwards, despite the presence of an experienced media source with a lifetime of experience searching out political stories. The group of 10 people discussed at considerable length the selection of a second candidate, including the name of one councillor. Quite interesting remarks here from presumably John McIntyre writing this. None of the constituency councillors were at the meeting. However, at least two candidates who contested the local elections unsuccessfully were reported to be present. Surprisingly, the name most mentioned during the night was the potential director of elections. So that's an interesting analysis there on the front of the Tyrconnell Tribune. And you can read quite easily between the lines on that. But was that a shutout for elected Fine Gael councillors? Derry News, it was us who got the life sentence. The parents of Martin Gallagher, the 25-year-old man cut down by a driver under the influence of drink and drugs at Halloween 2009, have spoken bravely of their memories of their beloved son as the 10th anniversary of his death approaches. And they're pictured, Martin and Elizabeth Gallagher, with a drawing of their son, Martin. On to the national newspapers now. We'll start with the Irish Independent. I'm sorry if you are sick and tired of listening about Brexit. You can put your fingers in your ears just for a wee while. It's hard to get away from it, you know, because it's imminent. It's coming up in the next couple of weeks, and it's not something we can ignore either, because it is going to affect us whether we like it or not. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's attempts to replace the backstop have been dismissed as fanciful. Addressing an audience in New York, Taoiseach Simon Coveney said that if the UK continued on its current path, it would amount to a disaster for Ireland. He accused the UK government of creating a much bigger problem to solve in the context of the Irish question. And it's all bluster, really, at the end of the day. I still just can't see how Brexit can happen on October 31st. I really can't, but the state of play again, and it worsens. I've never seen anything like what I saw in the House of Commons last night, watching a bit of it there. Just the mood, the emotion, the anger, the upset, and that's MPs trying to debate this. Unbelievable stuff altogether. A millionaire backer has withheld 250 grand in funding from Mayo GEA's county board in a row over governance. The clash was pledged by a foundation set up by UK's trader Tim O'Leary, who says he's already contributed 415 grand towards the county's cause since last year. Wow, what are they doing with all that money? no harm to them, but it's not necessarily showing dividends on the pitch. Is this for the entire county GEA? In other words, is it filtering down through the system, or is this for the senior team? I don't know. But the Mayo GEA International Supporters Foundation offered to provide financial support toward the creation of an academy facility in a centre of excellence. However, a row erupted after the foundation said it hadn't been supplied with business plans for either project. The Irish Times tells us that a no-deal Brexit could lead to Irish recession. This is a warning from the ESRI. And I think a couple of weeks ago I suggested that as we were talking about the budget and what might be contained within, that we're going to require a supplemental budget, surely, because if we're preparing for a no-deal Brexit, that's incredibly unlikely, I think, at this stage. We don't want to spend a year, do we, with an austerity budget once again. There has to be a supplementary budget. And the RSI are saying that today too now themselves. The government may need to hold a supplementary budget early in the new year if Brexit delivers a major shock to the Irish economy, which could push it into recession. That's the ESRI warning there. Elsewhere, we read that almost 70% of cyclists transferred to the state's main centre for treating brain damage were not wearing helmets at the time they sustained their injuries, new research has shown. Now, in terms of road safety, it is always the headline figure being, you know, deaths. But what we do know, I think it's 20 to 1, 20 people are seriously injured, many suffering life-changing injuries for every one that is killed, be it on the roads, in a car, as a pedestrian or as a cyclist. 70% of cyclists who've been involved in some sort of an incident on their bike that are transferred for specialist brain assistance, 70% not well wearing a helmet. 18 of the 26 cyclists sent for treatment to the National Neurological Centre at Beaumont Hospital in Dublin were not wearing helmets. And the status of six patients was unknown. A study of admissions to the centre over a 30-month period shows. So the non-wearing of helmets when people are cycling is causing serious, serious issues for those people who are unfortunate to be involved in coming off their bikes or colliding. Now, the Irish Daily Mail, teachers have criticised a report recommending that history remains an option subject in the junior cycle, not compulsory, an optional subject in the junior cycle. A review by the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment has recommended that no changes be made to the new junior cycle framework, which removes history as a core subject. That was removed last September. The Association of Secondary Teachers Ireland said it was disappointed with the recommendation. Now, these are the people that deal with our children the most in terms of a teaching capacity, and it's they that say that history should be retained as a compulsory subject. But that doesn't seem to be the case going forward. ASDI President Deirdre MacDonald said the call for history to be a core subject of the junior cycle has attracted considerable support from reputable academic figures and the public at large. The ASDI lends its voice in full support. I mean, of all the subjects to not be compulsory, I would have thought history is not the one. I mean, we have to remember our history. We have to learn about our history. Isn't that where you get a sense of national pride as well? Plus the fact it's just good stuff to know as you get older. The Irish Daily Mirror, more and more cash-strapped students are turning to sugar daddies to help fund their college fees. Every month last year, more than 50 undergraduates signed up to a dating website which pairs them with wealthy older men. The transactional relationships are in exchange for money, gifts or travel. The data shows there were 644 new sign-ups last year from 10 Irish colleges, while the total sugar baby, even the terminology is quite stomach-turning, the sugar baby membership of those same 10 institutions now stands at 5,404. The latest stats indicate four of the top 10 college goers using seekingarrangements.com are studying at Dublin-based institutions, with Trinity College topping the table with 762 sugar babies, followed by DCU with 681 members. So this is young students effectively signing up to this website, seekingarrangement.com, to be connected with so-called sugar daddy. These are richer, older men with a view to receiving money, gifts or travel. Now, what they give in return, I don't know. Is it their company? Is it? I have no idea. But in return from these older, wealthier guys who need to probably take a good look at themselves. In fact, they are the people that principally need to. They are giving these younger people money, gifts and travel. UCC sits just behind in third place, 666 members of this website, closely followed by University of Limerick with 601. It doesn't drill it down to figures beyond that. Critics have long panned the contentious service as a playground for ageing adulterers. Right, so they're indicating that obviously there's a bit of hanky-panky going on in this situation. But the agency's chief claims they're creating relationships with them which are mutually beneficial and which give female students the financial means, often through a monthly allowance of around €3,000, to complete their college courses. Now, have you any experience of this one way or another? So students are benefiting to the tune of up to €3,000. These are young female students. They're getting paid the money by older, richer guys, often perhaps in marriage or in relationships. And in return, whatever they offer, I don't know what they offer, but in return they get this €3,000 a year, there or thereabouts. It can be up to that. And they get money, gifts or travel. Okay. The Irish Sun tells us that hospitals are told to call off debt collectors. This was raised in the Dáil yesterday by Sinn Féin. Irish hospitals must stop using debt collecting companies to recover payments from patients. Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou MacDonald raised the issue then following the Irish Sun revelation yesterday. In our report, we exposed how 32 Irish hospitals pay. We covered this about 3 months ago, but anyway, in our report, the paper says we exposed how 32 Irish hospitals paid more than €5,740 to five debt collection firms to chase down patients for charges such as €100 emergency department fee or €80 overnight inpatient bills. And this is a local story here as well, because we do know that those kind of services are being employed by Letterkenny University Hospital. And finally, the Irish Daily Star. Irish drinkers, we all know this, don't we? Here we go. Irish drinkers are paying more tax on a pint than in all but one other country in Europe. So we are the second highest taxpayers on booze. A new report also shows that Ireland pays the highest tax on wine in the EU and the third highest on spirits. The report, commissioned by Digi, that's the Drinks Industry Group of Ireland, shows only Finland has a higher excise on booze than Ireland out of all the countries in the EU. Well, there you go. I was contacted by a listener who went into Letterkenny University Hospital last evening at 7 p.m. and 6 hours later, close to 1 o'clock, hopefully they got seen since then. I haven't had contact then. They hadn't even seen a doctor after 5+ hours in the emergency department there. Really, really slow, and to the point where people were actually lying on the floor of the A&E, the emergency department there, sleeping on coats and what have you. Awful scenes altogether. So we're staying with health. Adam Higgins, political correspondent with the Irish Sun. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg. Thanks for having us on.
No, it's great to speak to you. Now, the issue of debt collectors and their use by hospitals was first raised by you this week, the day before yesterday. Is that right? What was the background to the info?
That's right. So the background to the info was we were contacted by a patient at Beaumont Hospital in Dublin who had... He had something wrong with his throat, he told us, and he went in and got 3 different exams on it. Left the hospital, paid for 2 exams and forgot to pay the third. And he was shocked then that 7 weeks later he got a letter and a phone call from a debt collector saying that if he hadn't settled his debt in a day, then he would be ended up in court against the hospital. And he was shocked that he was just a slip of the mind, forgot to pay for the third exam, having been in such, in the hospital, in a kind of a dramatic circumstances, forgot to pay for one of them, and he was shocked that the hospital never contacted him. There was never a phone call from the hospital, never a letter from the hospital. It was just straight to a debt collector. So we decided that we'd have a look into it and see what other hospitals were doing, because this was only one case. And so when I looked into it, 32 hospitals last year had used debt collectors, and they'd spent over €500,000 of taxpayers' money on debt collectors to try and reclaim funds of patients who had missed their bill. Now, this includes your own Letterkenny General Hospital, who have spent just shy of €18,000 last year on debt collection services.
How much was that again, sorry?
Just shy of €18,000 on debt collectors. And what's interesting about Letterkenny Hospital is they've used 2 different debt collection companies. Now, one of them has taken the majority of business off the hospital, about 17,500, And then another one seems to have gotten just €250 from the hospital. So you can imagine how small the patient's bill was, that they were sending a debt collector, paying a debt collector €250 to go and chase them up for a fee.
Wow, unbelievable stuff. And do we know how much money they're recouping?
That's something that the HSE wouldn't tell us. And I understand it's not because the HSE don't want to tell us. It's because what happens here is if you owe, say if you owed what these charges that are being collected are what the HSE told me were statutory charges. So it's a €100 emergency department bill or an €80 inpatient charge. And the max they can go up to is €800. So that's the max you can owe the hospital within a year. And so the HSE told me that these what happens with your bill is they will sell it to a debt collector. So they would get straight up front off the debt collector X amount of money. So say if you owe them €100, they might sell it for €80. And then it's up to the debt collector to make his money by collecting the fee from you.
Okay, so what does that then mean? Does that mean the HSE then is no longer responsible for how these debt collectors perform their business? You know, what kind of pressure they put on people, whether or not they would take in other circumstance. The HSE at that point then has relieved itself of all of that care and responsibility, presumably.
That's a brilliant point, yeah. And it's one that after our report ran yesterday, we had it on the front page yesterday, and there's more on the story in today's paper. But after our report ran yesterday, Sinn Féin's Mary Lou MacDonald raised it in the Dáil, and she said the exact same point you're making there, that the HSE and Irish hospitals shouldn't be allowed to use debt collectors when they don't know what sort of tactics they're using. Now, we've revealed some of the tactics because what I've asked the HSE for as well was all the complaints that they got from patients who had been chased by a debt collector. And in one particularly bad case, the patient had already paid his bill through the VHI. The hospital made a mistake and still passed the details on to a debt collector. He was then contacted, and the debt collector threatened to call to his home to get the money. He said that he'd call, phone his work and ask for the money. He said that if the bill wasn't paid, that he might end up in court or they could publish his name in a national newspaper. And all of this having already paid for the bill. So, I mean, these are the tactics that some of these debt collection companies are using. And it's important to, while we talk about numbers and hospitals and debt collection here, it's important to remember that the people these are chasing are patients. These were in the hospital for a reason, you know. This, when you go to a hospital, it's when you're in the worst part, you feel the worst you've ever felt, you know. So you go to the hospital to get this treatment, and then afterwards, the hospital will send a debt collector to your door.
And it's not like when you walk out of the hospital, everything's rosy either. You know, you have the stress of what you went through, or indeed, you might feel you have to go back. I just wonder if people are at the pin of their collar, they come out of hospital, and a debt collector starts banging on their door, either literally or metaphorically. Does that mean then they go, well, I'm not going back to that hospital, and they sit at home getting sicker and sicker and sicker?
It's a very good point. And also, I think we need to link this in with the story you brought up at the start of your bulletin there, that hospitals aren't doing the best service. I mean, my brother was in the hospital the other day for something. Thankfully, he's fine. But he had to wait 10 hours in the emergency department to be seen. I mean, it's not as if they're handing out the best service in the world. And it's no fault of the doctors and the nurses. I mean, they need more funding for that sort of thing. And people will argue then, like, well, maybe how can we not use debt collectors? People will skip their fee if they don't.
Well, I could answer that question straight away. You've got another department, the Department of Finance, which has under its auspices the revenue commissioners, who will talk to people, who will come up with payment plans, and who will have some level of consideration for people's circumstances, as opposed to private debt collectors who are only interested in making a profit.
That's a very good point, and I think that's the key thing that we would like to see change out of this. These are small amounts of money, and the HSE is jumping too quickly to debt collectors. These are sick people, and more compassion needs to be shown when trying to get the money back off them.
All right, listen, thanks for that, Adam. It's interesting stuff. More in the Sun today. Thank you indeed. Adam Higgins there, political correspondent with the Irish Sun. So let's call this out, right? Two debt collectors have received a total of €18,000. Now, according to Adam, I did not know this, to be honest with you, and I find it really quite disturbing. They effectively sell your debt to these debt collection agencies. So the debt collectors buy the debt from the local hospital. This is according to Adam, and I have no reason to doubt him. They buy it at a discount, presumably, and then they pursue the patients for the full amounts. Now, have you had any engagement with these debt collectors? Can we have some information as to how they operate? What happens? Do they knock at your door? What do they say to you? Do you threaten you? Let's And when I say threaten you, I don't mean threaten you in any way physically. I'm on about, like we heard from Adam, the threat of court. That's when I say threatening, just by the way, just to be clear, that's what I would mean by that. But let's have that conversation. Have you been affected by this? Pick up the phone. Even if you're a wee bit nervous, you can speak to Caroline or Yvonne in complete confidence. 074-91-25000, 074-91-25000, or you can give us a text, 086-60-25000. Why are the HSE selling off these debts to a private company? Why are they effectively relieving themselves of the responsibility of having to show consideration, for example? Okay, it was announced yesterday that Letterkenny is to be the headquarters of the new Garda division of Donegal, Sligo and Leitrim. The division will be part of the new North West region, which will have its headquarters in Galway and a regional superintendent based in Monaghan. Of course, we had been platforming fears, and they were very genuine fears from politicians and rank and file Gardaí and more senior Gardaí and the public, and that these headquarters would be based in either Sligo or Manor Hamilton. But whether it was always going to be the case or that public pressure helped, well, it's going to be based in Letterkenny. Pat the Cope Gallagher, Deputy Pat the Cope Gallagher, last come caller. Good news on the face of it, you would say, I would imagine.
Yeah, I'm quite pleased that the Commissioner's taken the decision to locate the headquarters in Letterkenny. I preempted this. In fact, before that, I issued a statement calling on the Commissioner and the Minister for Justice to ensure that this would happen. But let me say immediately to the people of Sligo Leitrim, it doesn't mean that the concentration on policing in rural Ireland should be any the less there. It is a headquarters, and I think it's making a very clear statement. Donegal, with its 70-mile border with Northern Ireland, only 6 miles with the south of Ireland, that was a very obvious location for it, and particularly in view of Brexit. Because with Brexit, there are going to be changing circumstances irrespective of the outcome, and I think it's a good decision for Donegal.
Yeah, on the face of it, it seems good, but we have, and you talk about the Brexit context, we have the headquarters for the North West region based in Galway, which is a long, long way away from that border. And also Galway is one of the areas, if I'm not mistaken, that's piloting this new programme, which it's not really returning fantastic results. Have you any concern in that regard?
Well, of course, I think we have to take this step by step, and this is a matter for the Commissioner, its management. The Minister tells us that he will not get involved in this, but I believe this will take some time. But whatever the outcome may be, what's absolutely necessary is more resources. Mm. There's no point in having amalgamations for the sake of it.
But Drew Harris tells us that there's enough resources on the border, that there's plenty of Gardaí on the border.
Well, we'll have to wait and see. That's his opinion. Let's hope that we have enough and that the changing circumstances do not result in more Gardaí being required. But if they do, then they will have to be available. But if we just look at our own county, of course, there has been a reduction of 101 officers since 2009. We have to get back up to 2009 levels. Take a look at the situation in patrol cars. When there's parts of the county in the past that didn't have a patrol car, you and I discussed the situation in Bunbeg, also in Ballybofey recently. I believe that the Minister and the Commissioner must ensure that funding is provided. Take the decision of last week when the Commissioner said there's going to be no overtime in any part of the country. Mm. You know, that's sending out the wrong message.
It's a message that's been unchallenged, with all due respect, Deputy, not by necessarily politicians, but certainly by the media and the Dublin-based national media, in inverted commas, in that Drew Harris, in front of a committee or at a press conference, can say that we have, you know, loads of resources on the border, that there's plenty of Gardaí there, and that, you know, we have all the equipment, all the cars, etc., etc. But we know here that that's not the case. You've just quoted figures that show that's not the case. We know that the policy going forward is for Gardaí actually to use their own vehicles, because they're cutting the amount of vehicles in Donegal. And yet this information is not being challenged on a national level. I find it incredibly frustrating.
Well, if this has been challenged on a national level, then it's not been seen in the media. But we have to look after the interests of Donegal, and shall continue to do that. It's very wrong to suggest that we have enough resources. Of course, it's clear, and we've debated this on Highland on your programme regularly. We don't have the resources, and whatever the Commissioner's opinion is, he should deal with the facts. And I would suggest he was, I believe, in the Northwest. He should come to Donegal and familiarise himself with the enormity of our county, from the islands back to Lifford and from Malinhead back to Bundoran.
What worries me about that, though, is in an interview on this programme too, Terry McGinn, the top cop, really effectively here, said that she struggles to get that message through to Dublin. The uniqueness of our geography, that we are waterlocked on one side, landlocked by a border on the other, and we have this little slither, and it's very that attaches us really effectively to the rest of the country. That from even from her perspective, it is a hard point and hard argument to win with the top brass in Dublin.
Well, I would like to think that the politicians over the last number of weeks under the radar would have made a case, and I know I made the case in advance of any decision, when there was speculation that there would be amalgamation, to communicate directly with the Commissioner and with the Minister for Justice, and pointed out very clearly that Donegal stands alone. I describe it often to visiting dignitaries. It's the Alaska of Donegal, and when it came to the ETBs, it stood alone. It doesn't stand alone in this one, but at least the headquarters will be there. But it's pointless having the headquarters there unless we have the resources, unless we can ensure that we have proper rural and community policing to restore to 2009 levels, additional Garda cars. And of course, just let me make this point.
Yeah, but we'll go backwards in terms of the Garda cars. I know, but I want people to be very clear listening. That the reality is, whilst what we want is what we want, the truth is that the Gardaí currently are making, the top brass are making decisions that actually reduce the number of squad cars in Donegal, and because we're spending money left, right and centre out of Garda budgets on presidential visits, etc. And Gardaí are being encouraged or being asked to use their own vehicles to do Garda work in Donegal. So rather than it would be great if we went forward, what is actually in effect happening is we are going backwards.
I'm quite sure that this will not be acceptable to the Gardaí or to the representative bodies, that they should have to use their own cars. Of course, there will be a question if they're chasing one who are trying to apprehend, you know, whether they can break the speed limit or not, whether they're properly insured or not. There's a lot of issues there. This is very early stages in this, Greg, but it's important for us to be ensure that we monitor very closely. I know the Commissioner is meeting the Policing Authority today. He comes to the Dáil regularly to meet the Justice Committee. It's very early days yet, but on the positive side, important that we have the headquarters in Donegal, more resources, and we want to ensure that we protect our own people.
All right, stay there. Superintendent Noel Cunningham, good morning to you. Welcoming, presumably, news that the divisional HQ is remaining in Letterkenny, or perhaps, I don't want to put words in your mouth either, you have to take a broader view on this, of course. There is concern that when a new station is built in Sligo, that actually really, and we've seen it before, there are other Dublin examples, that really when this new facility is built in Sligo, that the divisional HQ may be moved there, and it's only really be loaned to Letterkenny during this process.
Well, Greg, I suppose you hit it in the head, the nail in the head there, because the issue we have in regard to this from the Superintendent Association, and I want to premise everything I say by saying we're absolutely not reluctant to change. In fact, we, as the superintendent rank, are the drivers of any change that comes through, and we've been part of it. Our difficulty in this regard is that we haven't got the underpinning document. And the underpinning document, if we got sight of that, would actually answer the question you've just raised. Is this a temporary measure, or is this something which is going to be permanent? And again, as part of that underpinning document, it will address the issues which you've raised again with Patrick O'Gallagher there. And that is, what is the policing requirement for Donegal? You know, I mean, we have no document which says that the level of policing required for Letterkenny is A and for Castlefin is B and whatever that might be. And then we would know what the requirement is and what it's going to be at and if that's sufficient. And we can sit down then and have constructive discussions around that matter. Yeah. And this is the real issue. And again, you touched on it also. because the whole issue around resources is not just people. It's the infrastructure that supports that policing. It's cars, it's IT, it's all of those issues, and indeed it's buildings. And unfortunately, many of our buildings are not fit for purpose for police stations. So there's a much bigger picture here. And yes, again, from the Superintendent Association, as you said, we do take the broader picture. And we did get some solace from the announcement last week by the Commissioner, because we had prevailed upon him that it was very difficult and very dangerous, we thought, to introduce the new operating model to the border in the teeth of Brexit, when we really didn't know what that was going to change, what challenges that was going to bring. And then a couple of days later, after meeting us, he did announce to the Oireachtas Committee and that he was suspending the operating or the introduction of the operating model to the division until we see, to the border, sorry, until we see what's happening in relation to Brexit. And this is important. But what we need here, Greg, is very simple. We need an operating model. We need to document which underpins it. We need to see what the implications are for policing in rural Ireland. What's going to happen in the outer regions? You know, you have centralised stations being set up and they will be resourced. But as outlined also by Pat de Cope, there are very rural parts of Donegal, of Sligo Leitrim, of Cavan Monaghan. What's going to happen in that regard? And we need assurances. We need assurances that there will be proper resourcing there.
Yeah, but we're being told, they say that the slight difficulty I have, and I've no disrespect to Mr. Harris, the slight difficulty that I have is he sits in front of an Oireachtas committee and says that we have adequate resources and that we're sending extra resources to the border. Yet we know, really, on the border, and I think we have the longest border along the border, is actually our numbers are going the other way. Our fleet is going the other direction. So we're hearing one thing being presented in Dublin, but we know a reality on the ground.
And that's why the document is so required. That's why it is so necessary, because it outlines exactly what's going to happen and what is going to be provided. We are, as you said earlier, we're only building back to the figures we did have in advance of the recession. So to get back to that figure is one good thing, absolutely. But the requirements of modern policing is more. And the Commissioner is talking about establishing specialised units, and absolutely they are welcome to deal with sex offences, to deal with historical cases. They're absolutely necessary. But those are not, those members are going to be taken from frontline policing. Now, so, they're not new coming in. So we have to make sure that if we're going to have these units, which are welcome, that we have the members coming in to the divisions and to the districts to supplement it.
Now, Superintendent, just as it's safe, for instance, let's take, for example, on the face of it, new border armed unit to finally deploy after criticism over delays. No surprise, and perhaps it's required, that lo and behold, where's it going to be? The place that's most in the news at the moment in County Cavan. That is not of great benefit to Gardaí in Lifford, who are in a very dangerous situation, maybe even a hostage situation with someone inside that may well be armed, and they have to sit there effectively twiddling their thumbs, and that's no disrespect to them, it's just what can they do until such time as this border unit travels from Cavan, presumably not through the north either, presumably it has to travel all the way to Lifford on the Republic side of that border.
Well, there is a unit already based in Ballyshannon, but again, have we sufficient numbers there? I don't believe we have, because I have carried out some operations and assisted in Donegal as an on-scene commander, and I have requested and required the support of the ASUs, and unfortunately they weren't available when I required them because of the rest days, etc. And unfortunately, because policing is changing and because the method by which we police is changing and the requirements and the skill set that those ASU units bring to a scene, a dynamic scene like that. Yes, we do require them, and we do require more in Donegal, and we do require more than one unit in Cavan, and we do require more than one or two units in Dundalk, as it is at present.
Okay.
The whole dynamic of policing is changing, and we must respond. And again, if you're taking people to fill those positions, where are they coming from? They're coming from frontline policing. Yeah. And I go back, and I'm sorry to repeat this, but we must get a document which says, and this is the perceived requirements, this is how we're going to do it, and this will not happen instantly, because recruiting, and as the president of the Superintendent Association, 3 years ago, I stood at our conference and I said, I named a figure of 800. We need 800 members recruited every year to get to reach a 300 to 400 net increase in our policing, frontline policing. And that's to allow for retirements, promotions, etc., movements within the organisation. Now, the Commissioner himself, because of cost implications, reduced that to 600 for this year. Mm. So straight away, that's impacting on the number of frontline
So leaders. Seeing as you mentioned that, Superintendent, do someone like me and others, do we have to be a little bit more fair then to Drew Harris in that he has got plans and he wants to roll this out and he wants to provide this here, there, or wherever it might be, and yet at a moment's notice, effectively, he sees millions taken from his budget to say, for instance, police Joe Biden or President Trump's visits to this country. So to some extent, with that coming out of GARDA budgets, is he operating with one hand tied behind his back? Is it fair for me to say that?
Absolutely. And what I would say is we have oversight groups, the policing authority he's meeting today, the Garda Inspectorate, and I would like to see them more involved in fighting that case for him, because that is one of their responsibilities. They should be taking that back to the centre, and they should be saying, how do you expect the police to put in place a special operation which was not planned for, which was not budgeted for, and then just get on with the rest of policing in the country? It makes absolutely no sense. No sense whatsoever. And yes, it is unfair on him. But I do also go back to my first point and saying, if the Commissioner is rolling out a policing plan, if he's giving it a presentation to the media where he's given the broad detail of it, the overview of it, then we need, as superintendent, to get the detailed document which says how this will work on the ground and what are the implications for our membership. Currently, the implications are that 32 of our members are not required under the new model. We have no indication as to what's going to happen to them. There is policing experience there, most of them in advance of 30-year service, which could be utilised to assist in rural policing, which could be utilised to assist in Brexit policing.
For sure, because to be honest with you, and no disrespect to these new graduates, we have a lot of them, and they're incredibly fine Gardaí and will go on to have very fine careers, I've no doubt. But you have to have a balance of new Gardaí and experienced Gardaí, especially if the situation on the border becomes more complicated than we would ever hope to see.
Of course you do. Of course you do. And you have senior members, and much of the senior leadership team on the border, like myself, have been there for many years. I have nearly 39 years' experience on the border, and that's reflected right around the border with many of the superintendents and chief superintendents that are there. And you require that to give the leadership and to have the corporate knowledge of what happened in the past. And we want to go nowhere near what happened in the past, what we believed during the
70s and the 80s. Okay. Superintendent, the phone line is going on us, and I fear it's going to drop altogether. Thank you so much, as always, for your very interesting observations. And I was hoping to bring you into one more time, Deputy Gallagher, but that phone line is also going to a drop, so my apologies. Okay, in fact, it has almost all but gone. You heard there from Deputy Pat the Cope Gallagher and also Superintendent Noel Cunningham, 086 60 25,000, because we know in terms of, you know, we could have this announcement that the, and we do have this announcement, that the Letterkenny is to be the HQ of the Donegal, Sligo and Leitrim Garda Division, but in the past, and there is this concern that it could be moved to Sligo once the new station is built there, because there are other examples. Fitzgibbon Street was replaced by Stall Street, Santry was replaced by Ballymun, and Pierce Street was replaced by Kevin Street. Those are double examples, but we have seen these decisions be temporary, and that's why the superintendent says it's so important that we see the document that underpins the commitment. Right, 086 60 25,000, that's the text line. A caller says, where is the meeting today regarding the erection of that phone mast in Letterkenny? Is it 11:30? I've heard nothing of any meeting or a time, so I can be of no use to you in that regard. My apologies. We've been talking about the hospital this morning, and one of our listeners, a few of them actually forced to sleep on the floor overnight using coats and jumpers to cushion themselves. They were in since 7. They hadn't been seen by 12 or 1. I've done 9 hours in there, to be honest with you, without being seen. So hopefully they were seen by now. But 5 hours as tough as it is, would not be the longest wait I've experienced there. 27 people, by the way, are without a bed at Letterkenny University Hospital. These are people that have been triaged, isn't that the word, and deemed ill enough to be admitted to the hospital, but there's no bed for them. Seven of them are in the emergency department, 20 are elsewhere. In Sligo, the figure stands at 20. In Sligo, pretty much south of, probably south of Lahey, in Donegal, you'd be sent to Sligo, or you might be inclined to go to Sligo. 16 people on trolleys in Sligo, 4 in wards elsewhere, right? Very busy on the lines again today. But before we get to today's texts, I just want to catch up on some of them that you sent in to us yesterday, because you do know, don't you, how much I appreciate it. We were talking about scams, phone scams. We got a call from our house to our house. The number coming up ringing us was our own landline. We answered it, and they said we had a problem with our landline. I would say you did. I hope your house isn't haunted. Joking apart. But they must be cloning lines then, but that's very bizarre. I got two calls yesterday from 01 numbers. When I Googled them, they are scam calls. I will no longer answer calls which not in my phone, and if it's genuine, they'll leave a message. That's a great piece of advice. And indeed, is it time that we recorded our messages saying that, you know, if this is not a scam, leave a message or something along those lines? It's an idea, isn't it? But this is what I was saying yesterday about the telecommunications companies needing to be held responsible. They have the technology. Surely they have the technology that they can filter out. There has to be some way that identifying that in some country, say, for instance, in North Africa, is dialing in great numbers into Ireland. Surely that's a flag. You could put a flag on that, couldn't you? Or the fact that the revenue scam was coming from a Dublin-based number. Do you remember that revenue scam? And I called the guy back and he accused me of insulting him and all that crack. Those were Dublin-based numbers. So they had to take, you know, the hoops that you have to jump through to take out a landline. So again, I don't think the telecommunications companies should be let off the hook. Don't forget, these are the same boys that if you're on a ferry to Wales and you accidentally answer your phone, that they are able to send you a bill. They can determine where you are and send you a bill for £200 or £300 because you're taking a call in international waters. So they have the technology when it suits them. And I think it's time they started employing that technology to suit their customers. Why is children's cancer at the highest rate it's ever been in Ireland? These vaccines are taken away from children's own immune systems. I was vaccinated, but I had measles at 16. Children are now getting 17 vaccinations. It's making money to big pharmaceuticals. Okay, but if you believe that, you have to believe that some of the most respected people in medicine in our own county, across the country and beyond, are involved in this. That they are in cahoots with big pharmacies. If you believe that, you have to believe then that the Minister, Simon Harris, that the Irish government, that the UK government, that the French, German, Spanish governments are all in cahoots with Big Pharma. Because otherwise we would know about it. Someone would whistleblow, wouldn't they? How could Big Pharma keep everyone so pinned down on this conspiracy to keep giving people vaccinations to make them sick to make money? Surely a government would come out and say, we know this is happening. I mean, the level of people that would be required to be included in this for it to be true is so broad. A caller says, I have two children that go to an Irish-speaking school but have started this year. Both have started this year. The school has organised a trip to a Gaeltacht area for one night, saying it's improving their Irish, yet they speak Irish on a daily basis. The school says it's optional, but it's not optional. When you have two children attending and all their friends are going, there's peer pressure on them to go. It's €80 per child. That's 160 for the two of them. They're only back at school, and with the costs of books, new bags, uniform, it's a lot of money to fork out. Are any other parents affected by it? I think you can feel for that parent. I can understand going into the Gaeltacht for 4 or 5 days, maybe a week, 2 weeks, that immersive experience, how it could work. But to go for one night, and that peer pressure to send both children and it costing €160, we're just back at school. You know all the costs associated with that. Is that unfair? Are you affected? 086 60 25,000. Catherine, good morning to you.
Hello. Hi.
You sound a little bit happier today.
I'm so grateful. I really am so grateful to everybody. Thank you so much. And to the stranger who found it and handed it in. I'm so grateful.
Now, for those who may not be aware, very, very sadly, you lost your sister in May, someone incredibly important to you. And you had an opportunity, because there was a little bit of warning, to go on a Thelma and Louise style weekend. There was fantastic pictures and memories of that. And also, through your grieving process, you wanted to be able to access the phone and read back some of those messages between you and your sister. So the loss of this phone, you felt it so, so very deeply.
Yes.
And we were contacted by someone who found it and handed it into the Gardaí, and it is your phone.
The Gardaí have confirmed it's my phone because it had my social security card in it, yes. I'm
going
to get it after talking to you, yes.
All right. And do we know if it's working?
Well, the phone was run over a few times by cars, but if the SIM's intact, everything's okay. I don't care about the phone. It's the SIM card.
Exactly.
Yes.
And even if the screen appears not to work, it can be connected by USB to a computer, and hopefully you can draw off any information you have to as well. So don't obviously disregard it if the screen is playing up on you, because the internals of it may still well be intact. Have you got comfort, Catherine, in your grief with the rallying together, the hundreds and hundreds of people that shared it on social media, the dozens that rang up with information? Has that helped you in your process a little bit to show how many people care about you?
Yes, it has. It's helped me so much. And just knowing that, I only think there's so few places in the world where this could have happened, and Donegal would be one, you know. So
good.
I'm so grateful to you, to everyone at Highland Radio, and to everyone that has helped, and especially the stranger who found it and handed it in.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you to everybody.
No problem. And if you have any technical issues with that, get back in contact with us, and we'll see what we can do with our listeners. Maybe someone can help. I'm sure you won't, and I hope you won't, but just in case you do.
Thank you. Thank you to everybody.
All right, God bless you, Catherine.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Okay, and it's lovely to hear Catherine with a lighter tone in her voice today, having got that phone back. And thanks to you guys, that is, that we were able to do that. And you're very welcome back. It's great to have you listening to the programme this morning. It is the 9 till noon show with me, Greg Hughes. We've another 2 hours coming up for you, and lots to keep you entertained on the show, and lots to keep you entertained and rewarded on the programme too. If you, that's Letterkenny, is that Letterkenny Credit Union? It is. Letterkenny Credit Union car draw is coming up on John Breslin's show, so someone's going to win a car live on the radio. And David James is giving away $5,000 in association with our friends at the Arranmore Blue Ferry as well, for all of you, the many hundreds and thousands of you that travelled out to the beautiful Arranmore Islands, including myself, but I can't win, of course, including myself over the course of that summer. Right, stay tuned, by the way, get your bingo books ready. I'm going to be going to the bingo numbers shortly. It's €9,200 today. It's €5 to play, €1 a day, effectively. There's big daily prizes every day in that jackpot, of course. Please play responsibly, of course. But you can play, win, and support the National Council for the Blind of Ireland, who do superb work for people with sight loss and vision impairment. And in fact, I'm sure we'll do a chat to NCBI to get an update on the work in the not-too-distant future. Why do people in Donegal, says a caller, never, and never's in capitals, use their indicators? I've driven in several countries, but I've never seen drivers as inconsiderate as the ones in Donegal. What a statement. Indicators, do you know where the stick is for them? Do you use them? 086 60 25,000. Just a wee topic, maybe some time for your show, says our emailer here. Every morning I do my usual in the town. This must be Letterkenny. Go for my runaways, head to the town park across from the hospital, and at 9:30 every morning, would the council not open the overflow car park? I've noticed the amount of people who park their cars and get out and head to work and walk out of the park. And how I notice this is when I go to a space, I see it. When I go to get a space, the most of the time I have to leave and go for my run around the town itself, as there isn't anywhere in the park. Even with my child, you have to reverse the whole way out to get out there to go somewhere else, because the overflow ain't open, they say. Now, I'm not 100% familiar with either running or that car park, but there must be a what you're saying is there's an overflow car park there. Use it, or should I say, open it early for those who want to avail of the park and run in the mornings. That would make an awful lot of sense. But also, are you suggesting in there that people are using it to park all day as they go to work? Is that allowed? 086 60 25,000. Okay, now you might imagine that if you were to, if someone were to sexually assault someone or to rape them and to video that, be it audio or visual, and then to distribute that, that would be a crime. But apparently, at least as it relates to adults, that is not the case. Caroline Cunahan is Legal Policy Director with the Rape Crisis Network Ireland. Very hard to get my head around that, Caroline, that you were actually having to come out to campaign on this.
Well, I suppose, Greg, the first thing to say is it was in response to a trend that we noticed among our rape crisis centres. They were reporting that survivors were telling them about this happening and being an increasing trend in recent times. And I couldn't really find, when I went to look both at the proposed new bill, harassment, harmful communications and related offences proposed by Brendan Howlan, couldn't find anything that absolutely nailed it. Mm. Now, this bill is great, and I certainly broadly would give it a huge welcome, and it's very necessary in many ways, but it doesn't actually have a separate variant of the offence which talks about recording or distributing sexual violence.
Because I can only imagine for
progress.
I beg your pardon, Caroline. I can only imagine from your client's perspective when they're going through a process or have gone through a process of actually trying to bring someone to account for this awful, awful crime, that this, that when this starts appearing again, it must be like the assault is happening over and over.
Absolutely. I mean, it's been described as rape by digital means and as a second rape by others. Absolutely it is. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Online harmful communications and harassment behaviours can be sexual offences and can have extremely serious effects as sexual offences.
Is it the case then that there are some laws that perhaps you could step into to try and get this stuff taken down, to perhaps prosecute anyone who might be distributing it? But what we actually really need is this very specifically written into law, so there can be no ambiguity, there can be no escape clauses, so to speak.
Well, Brendan Howland's bill does go a fair way towards that, Greg. He is proposing that there should be a new offence of distributing, etc., intimate images without consent, and that's very, very welcome. And the important point about that is that he's proposing that a single act of distribution, a one-off press of the keystroke that sends intimate images of a person to all and sundry, or to targeted individuals such as their husband or their employer or somebody, that will now be criminalised. At this point, all we have is the Section 10 of the Non-Fatal Offence Against the Person Act 1997, which does indeed criminalise harassment, but it's only in the context of persistence and, importantly, where there's communication with the victim directly. Mm. It doesn't target or even identify indirect communication.
So just to if we're clear, and to apologies to anyone who's the terminology might offend, but upskirting, for example, so that we see people that will hide cameras in bags or in shoes or what have you, and maybe on a train or a bus. That's what we're talking about. Not that specifically, but we're in the area of it. Yeah,
we certainly are. And the horrible thing about online sexual harassment is it can take many different forms. I suppose image-based sexual abuse is actually a better term. It goes beyond harassment, which is okay, important, but in an ordinary non-legal context, it is too kind of trivial a connotation. I think abuse nails it much better.
Sure.
Yeah, but that's an interesting one about upskirting. We do have an offence of interference for sexual reasons, something like that, Section 45(3) of the Criminal Law Sexual Offences Act 2017, which was very recently used in order to criminalise an upskirting incident. But the point about it is it's only incidents of which the victim is aware or ought reasonably to be aware, or would reasonably be aware of.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas an awful lot of these horrible offences happen by means of a concealed camera, and we made that point in the submission as well. So you wouldn't necessarily know if you were using a changing room or a loo or whatever that you were being targeted.
You'd have an expectation that it's a secure, safe and camera-free
exactly.
zone. Yeah.
Exactly.
Now, just as it relates to the recording and distribution of sexual assaults and the calls that the Rape Crisis Network Ireland are making in this regard, is it hoped that this can actually be included in this bill still?
Well, I wouldn't see why not,
yeah,
to be honest. No, that it might be a variant of Section 4, the existing Section 4, perhaps Section, put an extra subsection on it, you know, or if it were no more, at the very least, that it would automatically mean that it would be regarded as an aggravating factor in sentence. Mm. But personally, I'd prefer a distinct variant of the offence.
Yeah.
Which nailed the exact nature of what's going on.
Exactly, and now's the time to do it.
Whether somebody is a child,
yeah.
a vulnerable adult, or a person, an adult who's not regarded as vulnerable. But believe me, if that's been done or threatened to you, you are extremely vulnerable.
And very finally, you use you quite correctly pointed out the importance of language. A term that I despise using, to be honest with you, is child pornography. What is a preferred description of that, if you get what I'm saying? Because I don't like the way that one word is kind of normalised in society, yet what we're actually talking about is that the most horrid, horrid exploitation and abuse of a child. So what would a preferred terminology be there?
Image-based child sexual abuse or image-based child sexual violence.
Yeah, okay. All right, I will not take note of that. Thank you, Caroline.
Thank you very much, Greg.
Take care of yourself. Caroline Cunahan there, who's Legal Policy Director with the Rape Crisis Network. Right, back with more shortly. Stay tuned. By the way, we have our gardening slot coming up later on. I have the sheet somewhere. Here it is. Paul McLaughlin, gardener at Ballacthur Garden Centre, Manton, Top Letter, Kenny. Jobs for the autumn, generally tidying up the garden for the season ahead, because it's kind of a get messy, isn't it? You know, the leaves are coming off the trees, blowing onto your grass or your driveway or your gravel or whatever you have. We're probably going to have to just roll up our sleeves and go out and sort that out. But maybe there is some stuff we should be doing coming up to the autumn. And Paul McLaughlin will be answering your questions. Get them in now, because I don't want to sound like a cracked record and repeat myself, but we get very busy when Paul's actually on. So get your questions in advance, and then I can guarantee you to get you an answer. Speaking of the weather, I see we've a lot of rain forecast for tomorrow and Saturday. On the face of it, that is worrying, and maybe it's the southeast of the country that's going to get the worst of it. But what concerns me is, if I'm not mistaken, I believe we have the high tides this weekend as well. And we just hope that the rainfall and the high tides don't coincide with each other, and we could see flooding like we've seen in the past. Anyway, let's keep our fingers crossed that this does not happen. Right, we're going to be talking about the situation in our hospitals and the experiences people are experiencing. When we talk about figures, when we talk about 27 people without a bed, they are people, they're human people. We're going to put a face to one of those people after this break. Dee Fraser, good morning to you.
Good morning.
How are you keeping?
I'm not too bad.
Okay. How is Mum?
I'm angry. Well, we haven't done a proper diagnosis on her yet.
Okay. Listen, take us back to the start of the story in your own words.
It was on Monday. I had phoned because my mum hadn't passed urine in 25 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And her belly was very sore. But I know my mum. I've looked after her for the last 4 years, and I looked after my dad to the end, where he passed away 2 years ago. So I know myself what's wrong with them. They both had dementia and Alzheimer's, and you just know when there's something wrong with somebody. But anyway, that morning, the carer said another dry nappy, so I phoned and I requested for a doctor, you know, to come up to Mum.
Mm-hmm.
So the doctor came up, Dr. Armstrong came up, and I said to him, look, I just want Mum catheterised and then she'll feel a lot better. And he just looked at me and I looked at him and he says, I'm not allowed, no doctors in Ireland are allowed to catheterise any women patients. And I says, pardon? I says, I've been in Galway Hospital and I was catheterised myself with a male doctor and a woman chaperone. So I was a chaperone for mum, obviously. So he just turned around and he said, well, it's not going to happen. And he was going to get in touch with a public health nurse. So off he walked out the door, and a couple of hours later, I didn't know what was happening. So I got a phone call from Dr. Armstrong to say that the public health nurse was half day off and that mum was going into hospital. And I went, but she's got to sit in a corridor. But hours and hours, I says, I know what it's like. I've been there nearly every second week with mum. I says, I'm not doing this to her. It's not fair, I says, for this to happen. So he turned in, he says, well, your mum needs to be hospitalised.
Yeah. And
so
you can understand exactly where they might be coming from, because, you know, regardless of what you experienced in the past, there are rules and regulations in place, and they have to be adhered to. Very unfortunate very unfortunate the health nurse wasn't available, so you were left with no option at this point to transport or get your mother transported to Letterkenny University Hospital.
Yeah.
Okay.
But to be there on the bed for 19 and a half hours.
Well, start from the beginning then. So, were you able to drive her, or did she have to
be transported
by ambulance?
She had to be transported by ambulance.
Okay.
So, got to the hospital, and obviously she was seen by one doctor, and then nobody was coming. And
did she get a bed at that point?
No. She was on a trolley.
Okay.
Trolley bed.
Right. In one of the hallways or in the emergency department?
In the hallway and then in the emergency department.
Oh, okay.
So, then obviously a lot of people came in, as you know, with drunks, and they'll get top priority, which is wrong in my eyes. And mum never got seen then from medical doctor until after 3 a.m.
So what time did she go in at? Sorry, sorry to be going back and forth.
She arrived in there just before 6 o'clock.
So 6 p.m. And at this stage, she still hadn't had a wee. She was still feeling full,
yes,
presumably, and in distress. So and at that, when did she actually see a doctor from 6 p.m.? To actually progress a medical procedure, if you know what I mean.
I think it was about 7 or 8. I can't remember.
Right, okay.
Yeah, 7 or 8.
Okay.
And then she never saw anyone because it was busy, they said. And it was, I think it was 3:45 a.m, a medical doctor came.
Mm-hmm.
But had to get rushed away to the wards, so they couldn't, there was no notes, there was nothing they could do. So.
And that's 10 hours on a trolley at this point. Okay.
Yeah. So by that time I phoned the hospital again, and I said to them, how far now is my mum, you know, waiting to see the medical team? And they said, oh, we're still waiting for the medical team. It's really busy in here. So I says, right, I'll phone back at 8 o'clock in the morning. So I phoned back at 8 o'clock, and they turned around and they said that mum was being diagnosed with a urinary infection. And I went, right, so that's what they're treating her for. And he goes, yeah. So that was fine. So at 11 o'clock, just before I got the bus up to the hospital, I phoned again, and they turned around and they said to me, your mum's still here in A&E. And I says, you're having a laugh. And he goes, nope. So by the time I arrived at the hospital, mum was just in about an hour before me. So she got into the ward just after 1 o'clock. Into medical 5.
All right, so that's 19 hours later.
Mm-hmm. Then I asked one of the nurses if I could talk about mum, and she said, certainly. So she said, what do you want to know? And I said, I just want to know why, you know, what's wrong with mum. And she turned around and she says, well, they had her on a drip. They've taken her off the drip. I don't know why. We don't know what's wrong with her. And I said, well, could I speak to a doctor? And they said, no, you won't be able to speak to the medical team couldn't get to speak to a medical doctor until Wednesday. I would leave it till about 5 o'clock, and then you'll find out. So when I because I haven't been well. So I was at the dentist yesterday, so I phoned and I asked to speak, and they said, oh yes, your mum has been spoken to by the medical team. And I said, well, can you tell me what's wrong? And she goes, no, I can't tell you. She goes, the doctors have to do it face to face.
Right.
So I'll be up there, obviously, in the next 2 hours. Obviously, I have to get a bus up.
So you haven't had that information yet?
Nope.
Okay, so you're obviously very distressed by all of this, Dee.
I'm absolutely raging. I just can't believe it's a poor people. You see,
what angers you most in all of this?
The way that people are treated.
Yeah.
You know, the elderly should be top priority. Honestly, they worked hard all their lives and they paid their stamp. They did everything. They all went out to work.
They built the country.
It's just so, so wrong. And so many, it breaks your heart when you see all the, what's going on. And them youngsters coming in, I know, they come in drunk and out of their faces. And all they're wanting is their medication. And you see them outside a few minutes later or an hour later smoking a cigarette. And they had to get an ambulance to take them there. It just disgusts me the way it's run. It really does.
Now, your mother has dementia, but she also has issues with her back as well, doesn't she?
She's got two broken bones in her back.
Mm.
She's got two bad hips, but my mum's wheelchair bound now and hoisted everywhere.
Okay.
There's everything that's gone wrong with her.
How long have you been a carer, Dee, between your mum and your dad?
5 years. I did my end of life for my daddy.
And do you get a break at all?
Yeah. I get, mum goes on rest bite every 6 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how long does that give you to yourself, Dee, to recharge your batteries?
Well, it takes a couple of days.
Okay.
Because with dementia patients and mum just, it's like a baby, she can't talk properly. You know, and you're sitting there, but she's up quite a lot through the night. She's very agitated. But hands up to all these poor people that are looking after.
That's why I wanted to mention it, Dee, because if you weren't doing that, and you wouldn't have anyone else doing it, but if you weren't doing that, that would be a burden, in inverted commas, on the state, a responsibility of the state, so to speak, and it would have to be paid for some way. So the least you could expect that as your mum's carer, that when she does need medical intervention, that there's not a 10-hour wait to be seen. And it's now Thursday before you'll find out face-to-face what the situation is. Hopefully it's nothing too serious, Dee. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much and for listening to my story.
Best wishes to you and to your mum as well, and I hope she's back home with you soon.
Thank you so much.
All right, and stay strong, Dee.
Thank you very much. Take care. God
bless. Take care. That's Dee there and what her older, elderly mother generally tried to avoid the word elderly, because it's subjective, but in this case, I think with all her health issues and her age, that is the most suitable way to describe it, particularly with what she is going through. Right, 086 60 25,000, that's the text line. Staying with medical matters, my 12-year-old daughter was in Crumlin Hospital last year for 3 nights. They charged me €80 per night. I'm fighting for her medical card. In the meantime, I received a bill for €240. They keep ringing me to pay it, and I've said they're going to pass it over to a debt collector. I've been advised not to pay it because she's only 12. What treatment they did in Dublin, they could have done in Letterkenny, so a waste of time and money. I'd love to see a debt collector come to my door. I don't think you would, though, because a debt collector, it's not the HSE, it's not a caring doctor. They're in the business. They've already bought your debt off the HSE. It seems that's the way. Greg, I owed the hospital €150 a couple of times. It wasn't very long altogether until I was contacted by a debt collector. I just got a letter from them. It was all very civil, no threats or anything. I was wondering how they were making money when they were just charging the same as that I owed the hospital. But now I heard you saying that they buy the debt cheaper. Yeah, and I learned that information today right along with you. Any other experiences with debt collectors from the hospital? Your debt being passed over to this debt collector, being sold off cheap, according to the journalist we were speaking to, and the profit for the debt collector is in what they recoup, the difference between what they buy the debt off effectively of the hospital to what they get off you. That's their gravy, that's their ice cream. 086 60 25,000, have you had an experience? So far today, people are saying it's been civil. And when I, by the way, what I mean by civil, I'm not saying debt collectors would not be civil. Do you understand where I'm coming from? What I mean by that is it's not being threatened with court. It's not creating massive concern. That's all I'm getting so far. Maybe that is the way it is, and maybe it's a positive thing. Maybe that's the way it is all the time, if you know what I'm saying. Okay, we read in the Tyrconnell Tribune that the local community using the pontoon at Ballywarrisky have reacted with dismay after a pontoon serving small craft has been adrift at its moorings, or of its moorings, for a number of weeks, 3 weeks in fact. John joins us now, who uses this facility to just get a sense of the real impact of it. Hiya, John.
Not for that. All right.
Now, do you fish for fun, or do you fish?
For pleasure. There's about 7 or 8 boats use it every summer, and there's visitors as well use the slipway. But it'll be a month now. On next Monday, it was reported, and we were on to councillors, on to engineers, and they were to be down next day, but it all fell on deaf ears, and it's still lying there, and it's actually scrapped now because it's punctured. All the floats on it is punctured.
Jeez, what happened to it? Was it vandalised or just wear and tear?
No, just it wasn't put in right at the first day.
Yeah.
Just there were too much slack on the chains and that. And
just to paint a picture in my head, are your boats moored to this, or do you have the smaller boats and then you sort of go out to the main boat? What is the setup, John?
The fishing boats tie up at the pier, but this was just a pontoon for just leisure boats.
I get you, right? Understood. Yeah. And it's not working effectively at the moment. You're saying, is it beyond repair?
Well, the way it is now, it's unrepairable. Yeah.
It doesn't sound like it would survive a harsh winter, anyway.
No, it would not. No. But we were on to politicians and on to, as I said, engineers, and they were to be doing the next day, and it never came.
And there is a sense amongst those that use this that it's becoming sort of a regular pattern. Promises, but no action.
There were seven or eight wee boats tied up to it when it broke down, and they had to get all their boats in because they couldn't get out to it.
Yeah. And it's not insignificant. Like, it's a significant floating pier. It's not like a little, four pallets welded together or tied together. It's a significant thing.
Oh, it is, that's right, And there's another thing I want to point out, too, is the slipway. It's just beside the pier. There was a man went down 2 weeks ago with a four-wheel jail jeep, and his boat was quite heavy, all right, but he landed back in the water. Mm. So there's that much algae, and there are about 2 feet of seaweed on the slipway, which the council should be. There should be.
Now, that slipway, judging by the width of it, is that for launching boats, or is that slipway how you get down onto the pontoon normally? Because the pontoon looks out of position to me.
Two different. No, it's along the pier. The pontoon would be away from the pier.
Okay, right. I see it now. So you say there's a health and safety aspect to this as well. Hopefully, now this doesn't mean that the whole place gets shut down. But you believe it should.
There was a boy the last day too took up his boat, and he had a tractor, and he had to get a four-wheel drive tractor to pull up the tractor with the algae on the slipway.
Oh, right. Okay.
It's not been maintained at all.
Right. Oh, so really, just to make sure listeners fully understand and I, John, we're talking really about two problems here. Firstly, pontoon that is almost beyond repair, you believe, but also how you launch your boats. There's an awful lot of algae and what have you on the slipway, and there's concerns of the safety there as well.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Two pressing issues for sure.
But what I would like to highlight too is the locals, the rural community, from the likes of the Harry Blaney Bridge to Rathmullen, the rural community is neglected.
Yeah. Okay, well, stay there, listen, because Councillor Liam Blaney has sympathy for you and has raised these issues. Stay there with me, please. John, good morning to you, Councillor Blaney.
Good morning, Greg.
I mean, obviously, there's two elements to this. Firstly, as John pointed out, this pontoon is of no longer of any use for leisure boats and what have you. But also, the really what struck with me is the concern over how you launch the boats and a tractor such as the extent of the Algae not able to get up the slipway. That's a very pressing concern I would have.
Well, first of all, Greg, apologies because I did not hear anything at all on the radio this morning about it. I'm only had to get the phone call there now.
No problem. And John's on with us now, so that's okay.
I don't know what I was said, and I didn't get a chance yet to read the paper to see what was not.
Right, but, okay. But look, here it is in a nutshell, if you want it.
I know as regards the pontoon, that's what I told as was to do with as the pontoon down by Worskey Pier. And as far as that's concerned, I have been in contact with personnel on the county council this last number of weeks, a number of times. And I'm told it's going to be dealt with. And unfortunately, obviously, nothing has happened on it since. And I did have a motion down about something else to do with the marine section as was to do with over at Knockalla, the beach, Marawarden Beach over beside Knockalla, a couple of weeks ago at the municipal district meeting. And I did talk about the whole Milford electoral area, and I just caught the tail end of what John said there, and John just repeated exactly what I had said then, and I agree 100% with the statement, is that this whole area has been totally, the Milford area has been totally neglected from Downing's right round to Ballyhorsky.
Why is it falling amongst the cracks then, do you think?
Ballyhearn Beach, right over to Port Salon, right up to Rye Bridge, another problem up there that I'm luckily get work done on, and it's gone on this last number of years, nothing happened another. And as we see, a few weeks ago, the wall fell in to the sea up in Melton, and that didn't just happen overnight. That has happened this long time, and absolutely nothing has been done about it. And look, I'm getting away from the point I know about.
It's an important broader point.
It's a total neglect of this area, as far as I'm concerned, compared to other elected areas in this county that I think is getting a lot more funding, a far bigger share of the funding than what we're getting. And why that is happening, I can't understand. But it used to be like that, but it has got like that this last number of years, and I'm not happy with it at all.
What has changed?
Well, maybe personnel has changed. It could be part of that.
Is it a case that gets the oil?
I'm not going to start point the finger at anybody in particular, Greg, but I know personnel has changed, and there was personnel on the council was very good to this area as far as I'm concerned. And I don't think that's happening any longer. And I'm hoping it's not because of personnel. I know another reason as well, maybe it could be used as the same money is not available as it used to be. The marine section doesn't get the fair share of a budget that it used to be getting and that it should be getting. And it's something I'm going to fight very strongly for, and I have this last number of...
Yeah. This pontoon definitely is the council's responsibility, isn't it, Councillor? I mean, it is their responsibility to make sure this is safe.
It is their responsibility, and according to the man that the fisherman down there is in that knows about these things, it was never tight enough the first day, and it was batting about, and it was unfortunately batted against the rocks now, and broke part of it and burst part of it. But, you know, another pontoon that's been required and a foreshore licence that's been required over in Downing's and the boatyard, over Beaver Boatyard this last number of years as number one priority, supposedly, we've been told, this last few years. But something there, and nothing happening. And there's divers coming in from all over the world to go out there today. When you see the old pontoon that's been out on, it's a total disgrace.
Okay.
That's just an example of different things that's happening in the area.
The sense I'm getting from your frustration, though, Councillor Blaney, is that you're to some extent too banging your head off a brick wall, in that we know what the problems are, we know where the investment is. You're raising, and your fellow councillors perhaps raising these issues at municipal level and perhaps elevating them to council level, but nothing is being done, that this is a wasteland for investment, effectively. In other words, I'm not describing it as a wasteland, but in terms of investment, that's how it's being treated.
Well, I wouldn't go as far as saying nothing has been done, but what's been done is a lot less of what used to be done. And I know that the budget has decreased and it's not the same as it used to be, but I do still feel there's other parts of this county getting a lot more funding as far as the marine sector is concerned compared to the Milford electoral area.
All right. Thank you very much, Councillor Blaney. John, finally to you. I mean, you've got Councillor Blaney aware of the issues, raising the issues and fighting your corner, but he's as frustrated as you are.
Yes, Councillor Blaney was really good. He done his best. But I don't want to mention any names, but...
We won't do that if that's okay, John.
No, but I was on to councillors and they were MTDs and they're not far away from us, across the bridge, but could do nothing.
Okay, no, well, that's okay. Sorry, I thought you were going to get down to councils, regular council staff, but if you feel you're not being represented by your politicians, you're entitled to call that out, John. Sorry, I wasn't trying to mute you in that regard. All right, listen, John, we'll stay on this story. I know John McAteer obviously is on it as well. Councillor Blaney is raising the issues there. You want it sorted. Presumably, is it next season is the target at this point, or...
Hopefully, St Patrick's Day.
Here we go. Okay, that sounds good. And it's not. It's only 6 months away. All right, then. Thank you,
John.
Good man. Sorry, before we leave this, Councillor McGarvey, good morning to you.
Good morning to all of you.
Margine White.
Well, Greg, I'll tell you one thing has happened. Anything local now has to be brought before the municipal district. You can't bring it before Donegal County Council or the Plenary Council until such time as representative you're talking about the entire county. This is a step backwards.
So just to be clear, if this is raised at municipal district level, issues specific to the Milford district, are you saying that you can't table a motion to elevate this to a full meeting in Lifford?
Not specifically about anything that's entirely...
Yeah, but you're a clever man. You know you can throw a few extra words in there and get it on the agenda if you needed to.
Greg, you're making a mistake. I'm still learning. Mm. But I would like to support Councillor Blaney that for a long time. And that's no, I mean, I'm not afraid to say it, when his late father was there and when Neil T was there beforehand. Imagine that at the road out around Knockgallow when somebody thought it was nearly impossible at a very small figure. Maybe enough wasn't done at that time. But go back to the point, Greg, and that is this, like, it is regrettable because we're a boundary now in the Milford electoral area and the Letterkenny within the same municipal district. I'm not sure how it's going to work out because funding is the big one and he referred to it there. And I mean, if you take the things we've been raising about roads around Port Salon and elsewhere, and a coach wouldn't even get around them, and it's a wild Atlantic way.
All right, well, that's your job as councillors to get together and make sure that area gets its fair share,
well,
too.
Well, I can agree with any of them at all, and will agree with any of them within the Milford area that does anything for that area.
All right, listen, and you've lent your support to John and the other fishermen as well. Thank you very much.
Listen, Greg, thanks for taking the
call. No problem, Councillor. We're just up against the news at 11. Councillor Ian McGarvey, Liam Blaney and John, you heard from there. Okay, you're very welcome back to the programme, and we're joined on it now by Aidan Blake, Head of New Business Sales for Northern Europe and Emerging Markets. Good morning to you, Aidan.
Good morning, Greg. How are you doing?
Not too bad at all. Now, Grow with Google to kick off with a digital garage event in Donegal. Now, what is a digital garage? It sounds exciting.
Yeah, it's a great question, Greg. So Digital Garage is part of our Grow with Google initiative. So Google believes that Irish businesses need to be up to date with everything digital related. So we launched our Grow with Google program actually back in 2014 to help Irish people and businesses grow. And so over the past year, we've trained about 4,000 Irish businesses, and we're hoping to increase that to 8,000 this year. So Grow with Google, it's a global initiative that aims to create more opportunities for everyone. So in Ireland, Grow with Google really provides free training courses, tools, and in-person coaching to help people to get the right skills to find a job, maybe advance their careers or grow their businesses. So this year, we are bringing our Grow with Google initiative to 5 towns and cities around Ireland. We've already been to Limerick, Waterford and Cork, and this is our first event in the Northwest. So I'm absolutely delighted to be able to bring this to Donegal and to my hometown of Letterkenny.
So from a business perspective, I mean, say I'm a business person and I'm on the internet, I'm on social media, I've got a really great product. I'm not getting any traction, though, it seems, online. I'm not getting the page hits and I'm not getting, you know, I'm not getting pride of place necessarily on searches where I should be. Is there advice in that regard? So how people, if they've got a really good product, how they can make sure they maximise their market?
Absolutely. That's exactly what the main kind of premise of the whole process is. So we'll be doing a mixture of presentations on stage from Google's experts. And then there'll also be the option to have a one-to-one consultation with Google's digital experts. So exactly that situation. If you're somebody who maybe isn't happy with their online presence and you want to work with somebody from Google to maybe give you an option to have a bigger impact and to discuss maybe some of the challenges and stuff you're having, you can absolutely do that. So how you can reach more customers in Ireland. And also one of the big things we'll be really talking about is because of the uncertainty that Irish businesses are having right now around Brexit, how can we maybe help people to reach a much broader audience in other locations outside of Ireland as well?
And is this in conjunction with social media platforms like Instagram, Facebook, Twitter? Or are you sort of saying, well, Google's actually a better spot than that to try and get your wares out there? And I'm not trying to sort of set you up against the other big guns, but I'm just, there's a commercial motivation to this as well.
Yeah, well, there's a commercial motivation, but there's also, it's a kind of a process where we feel really we have to give back to Irish businesses, and we want to impact the Irish economy from a digital point of view. So, well, our kind of process is always we recommend to people to do all of those platforms you mentioned. So to have a strategy for Instagram.
You know what really works too, though? Advertising on radio. Just want to put that out there, okay?
Yeah, well, more of digital platforms, Greg.
We can work together. We can complement each other, all right?
Absolutely. It's complementary process is really the approach we always take for this. Especially for places like Donegal, you know, I've done a lot of work in the past with places like Brian McCormick's and Evolve Menswear and stuff, where I know that radio is an essential part of their media plan, and that's always something I tell them to do because that's one of the best mediums for them to be able to reach their local audience. But what digital does also is to give them other options to be able to maybe reach users in different platforms.
Yeah, now, just as it relates to an individual, because I get the impression a lot of the focus would be on business, but you also mentioned about people, I don't know, upskilling, reskilling, or how it might help the individual. So how could a digital garage help an individual?
Absolutely, yeah. So our audience for the event is very broad. So it can be small businesses, it can be job seekers, it could be students, it could be startups, it could be non-profits, it could be multiple ways. So we'll be talking around from an education point of view about the different tools that Google offers, but we're actually also going to be doing a one-to-one consultation process, as I mentioned, but at an event which is called I Am Remarkable. And this event is actually, it's the first time we're doing this as part of Digital Garage, and it's a 90-minute self-promotion skill workshop. So we've done this process all over the world from a Google point of view, and we've had great feedback because we know when people maybe are trying to find a new career or they're trying to go open up a new business, that self-promotion is an area that they really struggle on. Mm. So this is some areas from a skillshare point of view, from a workshop that will really help people outside of digital and outside of the Google landscape as well. So it's not just focusing on Google products.
And it's interesting too that, you know, the scale of Google, it's a global business, it's a massive employer in this country. Some people love it, some people loathe it, of course, but it recognizes the importance of local businesses in an economy, which is kind of interesting because some people feel that the state itself focuses too much on the likes of you guys rather than the small indigenous businesses. But Google recognize the impact local businesses have in any community, not least here in Donegal.
For sure. You know, I do a lot of work in the Middle East, and we really recognize, to be honest, that the SMBs or the SMEs of each economy are the main backbone and the growth engine of economies. And without a real strategy around SMBs and SMEs, it does make it difficult for economies to grow and to prosper. And Google really recognizes that. And we do know from, we work with a huge amount of SMEs here in Ireland, but also all over the world. And by impacting those in a really positive way, it definitely has a positive impact on the wider economy.
What's the situation for people securing a place at this event? It's in on Greenon Theatre tomorrow week.
Yes, absolutely. It's on Friday the 4th of October in Greenon Theatre. It's taking place from 9:30 until 2:30. So for those of you that are interested and would like to register, the URL is quite long. So it's events.withgoogle.com/digital-garage-Donegal. That's events.withgoogle.com/digital-garage-Donegal. And also, if you go to Google and you search for Digital Garage Donegal, you should also be able to receive information.
Can you not come up with a short URL? I mean, you're Google, crying out loud. You're coming up here to give businesses advice.
I said that to one of my colleagues.
Oh, come on. They're putting you on the radio.
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't read that out. Listen, some crack. But now, people can Google it. We'll link it. I think we'll link it on our stuff as well so people can get it. It's Friday the 4th of October in on Greenon Theatre. Obviously, there's not space for absolutely anyone, joking apart, Aidan, so it's important if people can express their interest now so you know the numbers and people can get in and not be disappointed. Isn't that it, really?
Absolutely, yeah. And when you register, you also have the option to be able to register for one of those one-to-one consultations or the I Am Remarkable training. So I would definitely recommend those who are maybe struggling with their existing business or thinking about a strategy from a digital point of view. It's a really unique opportunity to be able to speak to one of our own digital experts and to get that free consultation. So you can register on the form as well. And again, I apologize for the length of the URL. And I'll also be on stage myself doing a presentation. I'll be there to speak to anybody who wants any help or support as well on the day.
We'll give you a pass on the URL. Kamira, just from your own self, you're a Donegal man doing well with Google. Are you based in Dublin? Do you travel an awful lot?
I'm originally from Letterkenny. Actually, I grew up about 100 yards from the Ingrain and Theatre.
There you go.
And so I cover the Northern Europe and emerging markets for our new business sales team. So I do a lot of travel around Asia, places like Saudi Arabia and Egypt and the Middle East and stuff like that. So I've been with Google now for about 7 years.
Brilliant. It's great to hear a local man doing well. Thank you very much, Aidan, for coming on, and it'll be great to have you back at home. Thank you.
Greg, really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Take care. That's Aidan Blake, Head of New Business Sales for Northern Europe and Emerging Markets. That's the Digital Garage event in Donegal taking place Friday week, tomorrow week, in Ingrain on Theatre, and it's aimed at, you heard the benefits there of that. Downing's has not been neglected. John O'Donnell looks after it, says a caller. I'll check that number, make sure it's not John O'Donnell's. I'm only joking, I'm being mischievous. Of course it's not. Top the poll, for crying out loud. Betty Holmes, Greg, down at Farn, before you turn off to the Railway Tavern, a dong has been knocked down, but it's still living. Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, Betty. We don't want to move it, but it's causing traffic delays. It's a small brown dog with a purple collar. I'm sorry if that's your dog and you're hearing that for the first time, but it is alive. What do you do in that situation? Morning, Greg. Can I thank every one of all our new members who came to the AGM for Mulroy College Milford Parents Association yesterday evening? Can I thank Anya and Fonzie, who had been on the committee for the last 5 years and have now left? Thanks, Greg. That comes in from Tony McCarry, who is the chairperson. Happy to put that out there for you. Right, back with more on the programme shortly. Stay tuned. We're going to be talking gardening between now and 12. So if you have a gardening question for Paul from Ballacthair Garden Centre, give us a text now, 086 60 25000, or call 0749 125000. Okay, you're very welcome back to the programme. Now, just before we are joined by our next guest, a couple of your comments coming in. Anne-Marie here. I was hospitalised twice last year overnight. I got two bills, €80 each. Was waiting for my medical card. Telephoned accounts department in Letterkenny Hospital. Was told to ignore bills and to phone again. When I got the card, all was okay, was treated with respectful, helpful advice and dignity. Perhaps if people phoned the hospital on receipt of the bill, they wouldn't have any difficulties. But maybe if you didn't have the money and you're fearful. Every time I hear the script which you played earlier, it reminds me of Donegal winning the All-Ireland in 2012. That song they played when the players did the lap of honour around Croke Park. So I'll move this microphone over in this direction for our next guest. There you go. And it is Danielle Boner, Development and Admin Admin? Admin? Is it admin or admin?
It's just development worker.
Okay, that's all right. No flies on you, says you. You're not looking for any special treatment here. Development project worker with Donegal Women's Network. Right, before we start, can we start by talking a little bit about the Donegal Women's Network?
Yes. So we are part of a collective national organisation called the NCCWN, which stands for the National Collective of Community-Based Women's Networks. So we are one of 17 projects across Custer country. Yeah. So we are one up in the northwest. So there's ourselves, and there's one in Manor Hamilton as well, in Leitrim.
And you all work very closely together.
We actually had our national meeting last week in Dublin. So there was like 40 something women in the room. So, and we were talking about how we can move forward and sort of work collectively more so. So we are a group of women, strong women, I should say.
I can imagine for sure. Why do we need a specific Donegal Women's Network? Why is this not a Donegal People's Network?
Oh, Greg, how many times have I heard that line? Why can't we call it people? Because they are specific issues. We know, so men and women can face challenges. That's just life. But there are specific issues that women will experience because they're women. That's the reality. Like, we know gender equality hasn't gone away. Like, things have improved, but it's still there. Sexism is still alive and well. Gender-based violence is alive and well. You know, you speak to the Rape Crisis Centre or the Donegal Domestic Violence Centre, they will t- tell
which
you.
We've spoken to both this week alone.
They will tell you that there are major issues, and it is. That's why we call it gender-based violence, because it's specifically women are experiencing it. Yes, men experience it as well, but not on the levels that women are experiencing it.
And when we have to focus in a specific area, it is not to ignore or put down other areas. You know, it's about that there's a gap here that is so wide that it does require special attention.
Exactly.
Isn't it? So this is not to elevate one group of people at the expense of another.
No,
and people do get react like that, don't they?
If anyone Googles this, there's like that equality isn't a pie chart. You know, we're not trying to take equality away from somebody else. We're trying to balance things.
Yeah.
And the reality is, it's not here. Like, I was listening to your talk yesterday with Shauna, and you asked her the similar question, why do you need to have this group for LGBT community? And it's the same. Women aren't a marginalised group, but yet we will experience issues because we are women that men will not experience.
And as well as that, too, by coincidence, we do talk quite a lot about this kind of stuff on this programme. I never realised as much until as you're speaking, because, say, for instance, in the area of politics, you know, we've had this debate about women and their representation in politics, and what is the problem? Why is it there? But we sort of somewhat concluded that, you know, the system is set up whereby primarily women perhaps are still the carers, and they have to make decisions. I either go for elected politics or I rear a family. That's the way the system
is
set up.
And that is the reality, because we know that, like, we call them the five C's, the things that were identified by the Oireachtas, a committee, as to why there is a lack of women in politics. And actually, when I say lack of women, women are engaged in politics, but not as the big politics, as we say. So they're doing lots of essentially running communities.
You could make this same argument with the church.
You know
that the women, yes, are involved or in key positions, but they're a support network rather than those that...
Yeah.
That
so you said about childcare, and the childcare would be one of those five C's. So you have childcare, you have culture, which is a massive issue, not just within maybe political parties, as in culture as a society, how we view politics. And we normally do assume that it's men that are leading this. Then you have candidate selection. So that's a massive issue within parties, how they're selecting their candidates to go forward. Confidence is a massive issue. You know, we've identified that as a local level, not even to do with politics, that women haven't got the confidence to maybe go for a job or have self-worth, you know, and that's one of the major barriers. And I know recently we did some work with a lady, and she actually was asked to run for a political party, but she, again, like you said, had to make the decision. She had a young family. Could she invest the time because of her, you know, because of her family? And, like, I know men, there could be men that have families as well, but I don't think that they maybe weigh as much as women are doing.
And no, listen, and I am the man who does primarily what we're talking about here, to be honest with you. But so I know, I'm not unique, far from unique, but I'm not the majority. But here's another one for you. Talk about the five C's. WWVFM. Women won't vote for women.
We had this conversation in the office actually yesterday when I said I was coming on. Women don't vote for women. And I don't buy that, because what we're saying is we shouldn't be putting the burden on women just to vote for women as well. It should be a social thing that people are seeing a candidate and they're voting, whether you're a voter, you're a male or a female.
Yeah, I think, though, if this is of enough concern, women could say, right, I might be a member of Fianna Fáil, or I might be a member of Fine Gael, or I might be a member of Sinn Féin. In other words, put party politics to one side. And do you know what? Say, right, this is not normal. Perhaps we shouldn't have to do it, but let's get together as a group and actually, you know, move that 8 or 9% council representation up to where it should be, closer to 50-50. Let's put party politics to one side, even if I don't like them.
Well, I'm glad you said this, Greg, because at a national level there is the caucus, and actually that is cross-party, so TDs, female TDs, do come together regardless of what party, and to talk about issues that are affecting women and to address this issue of trying to engage more women in politics at a national level. And actually there is a conversation going on right now that maybe that's what we should be doing at the county level as well. So if you have county councillors that are female, that they come together and maybe form regional caucuses,
yeah.
You know, so we can look at some of the issues that are affecting women
because
and be
parties,
role models as well.
Parties could have got women elected if they wanted to. There were some fantastic women and some fantastic men as well, but we are speaking here specifically in trying to get this gender balance right. But fantastic candidates were put up against other strong candidates. There were strategic issues. You know, in fact, there have been three or four chances to co-opt onto mm-hmm. the council, which have slipped by. Even yes. by some of the most progressive parties, as yes. they have us believe.
Yes, yes, there are issues within those with the three major parties mm. in Donegal. After the local election, we did an analysis, which is up on our website. So if you look at DonegalWomen'sNetwork.org, you will see that analysis, and it breaks down how many candidates that each party ran mm. and what the gender ratio was that of that mm-hmm. was. And when you look at those stats, they're actually pretty bad.
Yeah.
And I know
and then throw in their tactical
yeah.
errors as well, which so you have to sort of somewhat go beyond the numbers, don't you?
Yeah, so there are issues, and that's what we're talking about, culture and the candidate selection being one of the two of those five yeah. think issues.
But definitely, particularly, I think, you know, we had some fantastic party female candidates who were members of parties, but we also had some women who were massive, they appear to have massive followings in the community, doing mm-hmm. really, really well. A lot of community, yeah. A lot of community work that they do. They were to the fore when campaigning on other issues relating primarily to women once again. And yet when it came to the ballot box, they were left high and dry.
I think I know who some of those women you're talking about are. And I would be disappointed for them as well, because I think they are leaders within their community, at a community development position. Again, I know one of those ladies, I think she was running against 16 people. And I think she was like, was two of women running in that area. Mm. So you, again, it's about choice as well.
Yeah.
You know, so actually one thing we should be really proud of is this year in terms of the local election, that we saw a massive increase in the level of women that were running. And that's actually really encouraging. Mm. Like we sort of say that you can't aspire to be what you don't see. So more women have run this year than they have in the previous, in 2014. Mm. Yes. And like, I think that will inspire again. I know some of those women actually will run again.
And there is very encouraging signs out there as well. If you look at some of the results, you know, so there's something to be built on there. But Donegal Women's Network goes beyond that.
Yes, it
just
it does.
So happens, it just so happens that we got caught in that conversation. And are you looking towards 2020 as being a big year for the network?
We are. Maybe? So, because obviously I emailed you guys in to say could we come on and chat about some of the things that we're doing. So, for example, we've still got a few things we're doing this year. We're speaking at the film festival in Ballyliffin on Saturday. So please come along at 2 o'clock looking at gender equality in conjunction with Donegal Changemakers. How can we end gender equality, and how can we end discrimination against women? And then we have the Women in Politics. It's not called Women in Politics, it's called Who Speaks for Me event on the 9th of October, 11 till 2 in the Regional Culture Centre, which is part of the Social Inclusion Week, which is looking at diversity in politics from a women's perspective. And we've got a number of guest speakers, so please do come along to that. Again, at the end of the year, we're doing a women's event in the Women's Centre on the 23rd of November.
That's about women's health, isn't it?
Women's health, yeah. So actually, it was built upon, it's actually partly funded by, again, Donegal Changemakers. So there's an aspect of looking at the global aspect here. But it built upon a campaign we were involved in around the cervical scandal this year, that it was part of an arts project that we ran three workshops, one in Greencastle, one in Letterkenny, and one in Donegal Town, where women came together and they sort of, through art, made sort of collages around how they felt about the scandal, you know.
And that scandal is live. I mean, if you were to break it down across the country, there's probably 1,000, 2,000 women in Donegal still waiting on results, still wondering if their samples were lying on a shelf so long that they can't trust the results.
Exactly.
This is still here. It's
still alive and
active.
Well.
Yeah.
And again, you can say, why was that? Why was it not addressed right from the get-go? And this is what we're saying, that there's issues that are affecting women that we need to be paying more attention to. So
the
this
health thing is particularly right throughout generations.
Yeah, so we're building on that campaign, and it's more like how women can build on their wellness and health, and it's a bit of a fun day as well. And the community artists that developed that initial project is going to be there on the day as well. I'm bringing all the pieces of artwork. So it wasn't just Donegal, actually, it was other parts of the country that were involved in this. So that's going to be a lovely day on the 23rd of November. And for next year, so that's one of the other reasons I wanted to come on today, is that we're looking to connect in more with women's groups across the county. We're hoping to do an event. In International Women's Day in March, which is the 8th of March. We'll probably look to do it on a Saturday and bring together women's networks and sort of build more of a collaborative network within the groups within the county.
There's a lot out there, but it can be fragmented.
Exactly. Yeah. There is. When you go on Facebook, like I'm all on social media, you'll see all these groups active, and it's to try and bring those together. You know, we don't have to meet all the time, but just meet even once or twice a year and look at what are some of the issues. So then for us as an organisation, we can start to address some of those issues, you know, developing programmes.
Is it important that we don't have loads of groups, including your own, speaking on behalf of women, that we actually, and I wonder, maybe it's done all the time, but do we speak to women, even groups like yours that represent women, and say, you know, actually, Donegal women, what do you want from us? What is lacking? Where are things going wrong? And maybe that is a conversation that's already going on, but does that happen enough, do you think? Do you think more could be done in that area?
I think so I'm a woman, but I don't speak for all women. You know,
saying you do. Don't get me wrong.
No.
And I know that your organisation and all of the organisations are doing the work with the best interests at heart. Don't get me wrong. And maybe the answer is yes, we do. So I'm not...
No, I think that is a valid question, because I think... We sometimes need to, every organisation, step back that, are we speaking for a group?
Say 50% of people in this country voted not to repeal, in this county,
yes,
voted not to repeal the 8th. So half of the women theoretically listening to us voted against that. Like, so say, for instance, those people in business or carers, or are they represented?
In terms of women?
Because, you know, a lot of these are very progressive and maybe people... Like, I don't know how you would have voted in various referenda or what have you, but I'm just wondering, are these groups truly representative of all women, regardless perhaps of their moral or political background?
And I think this is where we come from the Women's Network, that we... So there are individual groups, and not everyone maybe say they experience gender equality, you know. So we can't just assume that they're working this to address those issues. They're working that just to support women in that specific area. So we would, how maybe we're different is that we have that gender lens in terms of from a women's perspective, that they might be issues there because of their gender, because they're women. So that's how we approach it.
Okay,
you know,
so it's just on that level.
Yeah,
so
I can't
everything else is
speak for other organisations.
Yeah, okay,
you know, they have their different ways.
But do you understand where I'm coming from?
Yeah, and that's the nature of community. So that's why we are still here, because we want to make sure that gender and women's equality is still on the agenda. You know, that people are questioning, maybe are they doing it in this way to be inclusive? You know, the issue around, so we're talking about women, but also the diversity of women. And that's what the event on the 9th of October is about, is around not just women, but the diversity of women. You know, we have one of the guest speakers, Athioba, that she ran for election.
I mean, and when we talk about looking towards the future, I mean, the results that she got, something like 600
first
preference votes.
She did really well for a first-time candidate.
If things had changed, if things had been... now, theoretically, she had a lot going against her, you know? But people came out and voted for her in big numbers, and she'll be back.
Yes,
and I think she'll get elected.
She will be back.
No, but I think she'll get elected. But what I'm saying is if you want to say, well, where are we at? You could look to her performance and say, well, actually, you know, maybe our starting base is not as far back as we thought it was.
Yeah, and that's what I take some positives from the local election. Like, we did get one extra woman this year, so we have 4 out of the 37 as opposed to 3 out of the 37. So there are things, and gender equality,
grasping at straws.
God,
it doesn't happen. We went from 3 to 4.
I wish it was maybe a lot more than that, but like, to acknowledge achievements where they've been gained, you know. And if we look at any inequality issue, regardless of where they are in the world, they weren't fixed in the day. They were slow-moving processes, and that's, unfortunately, that's the nature. And I know, as me and maybe other women that are working in the sector, have to acknowledge that it's a slow process. And that doesn't mean we're not going to keep talking about it.
Yeah.
because that if you do, you know, it's
a, we have to have each other's backs too in society, generally speaking,
and if that is
within gender groups.
And I want to say as well, another note, that we have a new generation of people coming through. Like, we would work in schools as well, like actually through the funding of DLDC, mm-hmm. Looking at gender equality, and some of the views and the attitudes of young people is actually really inspiring. Like, there are still major issues. You know, a lot of the young girls would talk about some of maybe unwanted attention or low level, or say sexual violence that they're experiencing. And then we also work with young men as well, and they would talk about some of the experiences from a gender aspect from their point of view. Like, I always talk about mental health for young men, you know, so I don't want to think, so we are working with men and women to address this issue.
What we need to do, because, you know, what there this is almost about setting the stage for people coming through, because there is a change of common, right? But what we don't want, be it men, women, or whatever, getting involved in politics or community work or whatever, is the traditional blockers, you know, maybe nepotism or whatever it might be, you know, because if you've got a new generation coming through, and we've seen what they're capable of with the recent climate action, but the system can't frustrate them. That has to be changed now, doesn't it?
And that's
so that as they come through, that their enthusiasm, yeah,
that's what we talk about,
remains.
Culture. And culture can also be power. And the examples that you've just raised there is around people sometimes wanting to maintain power, and they're not reflecting on actually, they think that they're right for the job, but are they really right for the job? So these are all,
again, is that a rhetorical question?
These are all right. These are all questions that we will be asking at the event on the 9th as well, because this is a major challenge. How do you
And that's an important view, because regardless of if you're a man or a woman, most men, their mums are mums, their sisters are women. You know, their mums are women, their sisters are women, their grannies. We're talking about older ladies, right, down at the hospital and how they're being treated. Equality is not man versus woman. This is everyone, regardless of your gender or how you identify, should want everyone to be equal, because they're your loved ones, they're your partners, they're your brothers, your sisters, they're your daughters.
You'd think though, so, Greg, if that's the, we have, everyone is related to men and women, but the reality is people still hold biases.
Am I the only person sick to death of women's groups continually branding the male gender as all that's wrong with society? Women voters are fed up with hearing their husbands, sons and other male relations as violent sexual predators.
I don't think we said that at all.
I don't think there's an anti-man narrative. Do you know, we do talk about a lot of this stuff, and I've never encountered an anti-male narrative in it, if you know what I mean. Or if that's never, ever come across.
No.
It's about elevating, like we said at the beginning, do you know?
In fact, I'm working at the moment with Freuger in Ballyshannon, and my co-worker is a male, and we had this conversation that when we talk, there's a maybe misconception about when we talk about gender equality, especially for us as a women's organisation, we are talking about balance. It's not about bashing the opposite sex.
Yeah.
That's not, hence why I work with young men. You know, I would have done work last year in St. Union's, and we had these conversations because I was told that they thought a feminazi was coming in. And
so even that terminology.
Yeah, exactly.
Once you're in
and
that
they'd
space
actually,
here.
They'd actually met me before for another workshop that I was doing. And so obviously then I went in to do this workshop on gender equality, and I, so once we were doing activities and we were sort of looking at issues, and I said, oh, what about language and like this word? And they went, oh, Danielle, who said that to you? Who said that to you? And I was like, I'm not saying, I just know that was said. And they went, no, we don't think you're that. We don't think you're that. But again, people use words.
Strong connotations.
It is. And that's what I said to them. Like, you know, that's a serious word that you're throwing around.
Right. So other than the events, how do people, women, feel that they're being represented by the Donegal's Women's Network? Do you sign up to it? Do you go to events?
Go to events. That's, again, so we are active on social media. So we recently set up just a group attached to our page for women in Donegal. So we're really trying to get women to sort of join that group so we can have conversations. Like, I will be posting questions so that we can gather some sort of information and sort of collecting data as to maybe what are the gaps within the county, because for we can reflect on those of what
Which
can
is
we do
kind of
to
what
address
I was talking
those.
About earlier. So, you know, you are sort of pooling and saying, you know, it's anecdotal to some extent, but where can we be going? What are we missing on?
But
do you feel
first,
included?
Yeah, that's the first step to create change, essentially.
Right. Okay. Anything else you want to add? So the event, Who Speaks For Me? Women in Politics, social inclusion event. That's on the 9th of October. The women's health event's coming up in November. People can check your Facebook for all this stuff. Women's Lives, Women's Voices series.
Yeah, I didn't. So thank you for mentioning
it. You're very welcome.
So we used to run a series in the Donegal Democrat. That sort of came to an end when people weren't maybe buying newspapers as much. So we've now started to do this online instead. We need to do it every week. We're doing it every month now. So we're looking for women to sort of contact us about maybe it's a story or the area of interest that they're interested in. For them, they can write a piece, or it could be a case that we go out and interview them, you know, and then we help them write the piece up, and then we feature it. So for this year, we've had quite a few around in the environment and sustainability, which actually have been actually really amazing, like practical steps that women have sort of adopted into their home to reduce the level of plastic. And like, I know I saw some of the tips that they were using. I was like, right, I can do this in my own home.
Yes, it's workable.
You know, we've had stuff around IVF, you know, and miscarriage.
And the journey that people have gone with IVF here in Dublin.
Having a lady has written a number of pieces from a historical point of view, one of the researchers. So again, acknowledging the achievements that women in Donegal have made in history. And then one that we're coming up in October is actually around what you do when your life doesn't change its course. And it's actually, I'm not going to leave it there, because we'll post it on the 1st
of
October.
Here's one for you, and maybe I should do this on my program. I don't know why I'm giving you ideas. But I do wonder if have we actually figured out our roles in relationships, you know, men and women's relationships primarily, about
healthy relationships.
Healthy relationships, but I'm not about and raising a family.
Yes.
Right. So say me and you are married and we have children.
No, we're not married.
Yes, let's just say we did. Close your eyes for a second. So say we did and we have children, okay? Who gives up their career?
Well, again, that's the combat.
And if you do it, would you feel resentment for doing that? You know what I mean? And how does that impact on relationships? Because I think we're in a new space. And I think there's a real conversation to be had on that, on what, whose role is what?
And is it a role? That's the key there. It's a conversation, not an assumption.
Yeah.
Because you might have situations where it's an assumption that that person's going to give up
their
job.
Precisely, exactly. And do you have that when you're engaged? Do you have that conversation?
So maybe people might feel uncomfortable about having these conversations. I think they do go on, because I've spoken to people and said, oh, we've had that conversation, you know, like from a financial point of view. And then they sort of have that conversation around, okay, well, I'm giving up my job, but just making sure that the pay that comes in is then distributed equally.
Yeah, but there's more an emotional side to it too, because you give up your life, I give up my life, not give up your life, because wearing children's not giving up your life. But then they get to 13, 14, 15, and they don't really need you anymore as such, you know. And then they're going, well, I'm 10 years out of my job. Why am I here? And do you know what I'm about?
And actually, we have a program called Women in the Home.
Yeah.
And that's sort of some of the women that are in that situation that have maybe given up their jobs, or they've stayed at home to be a stay-at-home parent, and then children have grown and got older. They don't need as much support in terms of there all the time. Where am I at? What do I do?
But that's also more men are feeling that now, you see, because there are situations where things are changing. And that's where I'm on about the dynamics of all of that. And I think it's something we're going to see more and more of. Right. Give us your Facebook page, URL, your website. Which
it's literally, we are on Facebook and we're on Twitter. So we just the hashtag @NCCWN Donegal. That's all you have to remember.
Listen, Danielle Bonnet, it's been very interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Greg.
With more after the break. Hey, Paul McLaughlin, gardener at Ballathurg Garden Centre at the Mountaintop, Letterkenny. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We are in it now, isn't it? It's autumn.
Yeah, very much so. All right.
Just a wee bit closer.
Today's the first day of the wee boys. Why do we have to get up whenever it's dark?
I don't know what time you're getting up at, but it's early. But I can feel his pain, don't get me wrong. Right, since we last spoke, has anything moved on in terms of the seasons and where we're at and what we should be at, or what do we need to be doing to be winter ready in our gardens?
Yeah, funny, last week we actually had a sort of unseasonal wee worm spell, you know, and actually brought all the summer bedding right back again. So it's actually looking very well at the minute. So I'd say just from this week on, things are turning colder, so it'll be time to get into the autumn preparations.
I think that's the reality too, isn't it? With the hopes now of any Indian summer, I think we've had that.
I think the best passed, all right.
Then. Okay, right. Can I cut back hydrangea now they're very leggy?
Now'd be a good enough time. If the hydrangea's still looking quite well, you could leave it for another few weeks, if you know what I mean. But now, if they are looking leggy, you can cut them back anytime. You'd be quite hard, cut them back quite hard too.
How can you maintain wildflower? It was down in springtime, and this year it was sown in springtime of this year, and it was fully grown during the summer, and there's still life in it, but do we cut it back now?
It really depends on the mix. Our wildflower is very much popular at the moment because it's so great for biodiversity.
Is this where it kind of looks disorganised, but it's organised?
You get a great display of flowers in the summer, and it's all great for pollinating insects and stuff. I would tend to leave it a wee while now because the seed heads have formed a lot of the flowers, and actually for wee bird stuff to get there, we'd love to eat them
right
at the minute, and that helps to distribute the seed as well. So you generally storm them once a year, sometimes sort of late autumn or early spring, and the effect of storming it distributes the seeds for next year.
Excellent. And is this when people sow wildflower, is it instead of a lawn or is it as part of a lawn, or on what scale do they do it?
A lot of people would be devoting part of the garden to it, maybe all of it. Right. A lot of more amenity sites is actually going now. There are a lot of even factories now using their surroundings doing wildflower because it is so good for biodiversity and for the bees are under pressure.
And it does look nice. It's like organised chaos. In other words, it's what you traditionally might feel you should go in and take down. But if you in terms of strimming it, whatever you cut, does it just lie there?
Pretty much just leave it lying there.
So
right,
you don't have to
like I say, the seeds are coming off it.
Okay.
So let's disturb them again for next year.
What's the best time to snip or slip hydrangea? And should the slips be set in separate pots? Tell us what slipping is, because this person knows their stuff.
Yeah, slipping is just taking a cutting to sort of clone the plant to get a new plant.
Where do you do that on the plant?
Generally, you do the last 6 inches of this year's growth.
Okay.
You would clip off that piece of the branch, clip off the bottom leaves, and just leave about 2 leaves on top of it, and then just set it down into soil.
Uh-huh.
And theoretically, it should root. And like I say, clone the plant, and you have a new plant for
brilliant. Okay.
For nothing, if you know what I mean.
And at the same time, you're pruning the existing plant.
Exactly. Yeah. So what it is, it's the traditional way people would have probably given plants.
So the best time, did you say, sorry?
Wee bit late now, probably early summer for hydrangeas is perfect time. But it's still worth a try because they're quite slow to root, but they're very easy to root.
Understood.
So no, I wouldn't go single pot. I would put 3 to 5 in every pot.
Pardon my ignorance. Is that indoors or outdoors?
Oh, outdoors. Okay. Hydrangeas love a shady spot. So summer is sort of damp and shady now over the winter. Perfect for it.
Right. What's the best time to plant hydrangea? People loving the hydrangea.
Now is a perfect time. Plant them. Actually, they'd be established by the time the worst of the winter hits.
Okay.
They'd be very hardy old plants and they'd be very easy grew on them.
Perfect for us. Mm-hmm. Is this the correct time to cut back blueberries, gooseberries, blackberries and red currants?
Yeah, now would be perfect time. The fruit should have passed. You should have harvested your fruit at this stage, so you can cut them back quite hard at this stage.
Okay, so. And when you say that, just in case it's their first year at it, how do you go at them?
Pretty much cut them back by about half.
Okay.
To each branch almost and bring it down then, and then next year's growth will produce the fruit.
And the offcuts, are they of use for anything?
Gooseberries, blackcurrants are easy to propagate much the same way as you would do with hydrangeas.
Are they're easy to grow, aren't they?
Oh, very easy to grow, all right, yeah.
All right. You can make quite a nice sort of a fruit garden out of that stuff, can't
absolutely,
you? Because they're quite organised if you look after them, aren't they? When's the best time to cut back a green hedge?
An evergreen hedge, now is a perfect time. Just any time you can cut it back, as long as there's no frost forecasting about the next 4 days, where the frost could get into the cuts and do damage, if you know what I mean. So once there's no frost forecasting, you should be grand for another month.
Yeah, okay. So cold weather is grand. We're talking about sort of sharpness of a frost.
Exactly. I say it goes down -3, -4 at night time, you know.
I have a gardening question for you. Well, I hope it's not for me. I keep seeing a warning sign for Japanese knotweed. I'm wondering what it is.
Yes, Japanese knotweed, it's a plant that was introduced here in the 1800s and it's very, very invasive. And once it can grow from like 1 centimetre part of a leaf or a stem, will actually grow and formulate a new plant. And the fact of the matter is, it's so invasive and it's causing a bit of destruction at the minute, so people are trying to get rid of it.
And it's overpowering to native species.
It's overpowering to native species, and a big problem.
Damaging to concrete and property and whatever, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's sort of debatable. The main place it's doing damage is in riverbanks. It's killing off the native stuff.
Yeah.
And then it dies back to nothing for the winter and leaves just exposed soil, which gets washed down the river and probably is leading to more flooding. And
there you go. What would be on the banks is being... Yeah, that's actually quite an interesting connection. Right or wrong to continue feeding hybrid roses at this stage? Are they half petrol, half electric?
That's more or less... Yeah, traditionally, a hybrid rose is one with a bigger flower. A Floribunda has more smaller flowers.
Yeah.
So feeding it this time of year is probably not going to do you a lot of good. It's going to do no harm. if you know what I mean. Yep. But I would say generally a balanced rose fertiliser you would put on around St Patrick's Day at the start of the growing season, and then just as they're starting to flower, I would say mid-June, July, and that should do it for the season.
I have a lot of wooden garden furniture and no storage space. Last year I bought furniture covers, but they appear to have disintegrated very fast and not much use to me this year. I wonder if there's a special type of cover you could recommend, or special paint I could give them a coat before putting them aside this winter, because they don't want to take off in spring and having to go back shopping again.
Absolutely. No, the paint very much depends on whether it's actually wooden or whether it's painted furniture, wood thing. But what I've found has been good in the past, furniture covers, more or less you get what you pay for. If go for the cheaper, you can get more expensive ones at work. Or another option is, nobody get like a cover for a classic car.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be quite good quality, maybe a bit more expensive, but they would work well.
And big too.
Exactly,
and you can put more than maybe the furniture underneath, something like that. You know,
exactly. You just bunch all the furniture together and get under one cover. If
okay.
You know.
What type of leafy evergreen tree would you recommend for boggy soil near the sea?
Boggy soil near the sea, it's very hard to get an evergreen tree, but something like sea holly, the Oleraria, would probably do the job, or a rhododendron even.
All right.
They really suit boggy ground.
I have two tomato plants which were green, but now they've gone black all of a sudden. Did I do something wrong?
Possibly not. A lot of the time, watering tomatoes can be a very sort of balanced affair, if you know what I mean. So possibly someone went
you can kill
there,
them with kindness, really, can't
pretty
you?
Much. Yeah. Or you get late season blight. It happens in tomatoes too.
I have tried to grow so many flowers like marigolds, pansies, but something's eating them. I don't know why that made me laugh. It didn't make me laugh, sorry. It's just the whole notion of it. People put in so much effort and something comes along and destroys it. What would your advice be to put in to help them?
Like I said, there's more than likely slugs that's doing the damage, slugs and snails. So if you just kind of keep vigilant, it would actually keep the vigilance up and try and remove them as best you can.
Okay, Paul, thank you. That's Paul McLaughlin, gardener at Bagdirk Garden Centre Mountain Top. I think we pretty much got to all of the questions that came in this morning. We'll be back with more tomorrow morning at 9. We've got an excellent Friday panel lined up for you, so hopefully you'll join us for that. And we have our entertainment slot as well at 11 o'clock tomorrow. So lots to keep you entertained.